For this talk, I am speaking on behalf of my colleagues at the University of Washington about the game Control-Alt Hack, which we created. And this isn't actually a talk about cake, but Tammy thinks it's important that you know you can have your cake and eat it too. That when we wanted to think about education, one of the things we wanted to think about was what we wanted to achieve by creating a game. And we spent some time on this, and the thing that we came to that we felt was really important was recreational voluntary play, that people would play this game because it's fun. And the educational goals are very important, and we've evaluated them and published on what it means in the classroom. But the reason that we wanted to think about fun as a goal in a serious game, in a purposeful game, is because there's a lot of people who are thinking about what they're going to do, and they don't necessarily believe that there's, they don't necessarily know that there are careers in security which they can go into, be successful, make money. They don't think that these careers are for them. And so a number of the things which we did in the game, which are designed to deliver those messages, are a little on the subliminal side. They're not whack you over the head with the learning goals that obtain. They're, you pick that, you may or may not pick it up as you're playing. And so one example of that is, as we were thinking about the characters in the game, let me pause and say, Control-Alt-Hack here, you play the part of an ethical hacker, one of these folks, and since we're giving these away, I'm not gonna open it up and wave the cards around, but you play an ethical hacker who goes on missions, and the hackers that you play are gender balanced, they're ethnically diverse, they're geographically diverse, they have interests outside the game, because we wanted people to feel that they could be this person, that this person could be them. And so as we started doing this work, we realized that there were quite a few trade-offs, that you can't have all of the cakes, that there were goals that we wanted to pursue that we simply weren't able to fit in while delivering a game that was going to be attractive. And actually, I was talking to someone during the break, and they said, oh yeah, I saw that game in our lab, in our lab's common area, and it's gone now. And I take that as a huge success, that the game was enough fun that someone stole it. because when people want to play the game independently of the educational values that they take from it, it gives us as game designers additional opportunities to expose the educational messages to additional people. It gives us reinforcement opportunities that people will see the messages over and over again. And so I'm tremendously excited that copies have gone missing. But some of the trade-offs that we needed to make are, how much detail do we put in terms of the technical level of the game? One of the critiques that have come back from security educators at the college level is we don't teach anyone how to code a buffer overflow. It's true, we do not. How much calendar time we put in, how much we were going to spend. We were fortunate that the National Science Foundation, Intel, gave some grants that allowed us to spend money on high quality design and production. And we could have spent that money in a variety of ways. We could have produced a lower quality game and printed more copies. We might have done something electronic. There's lots and lots of trade-offs that are available. And as we started thinking about what we wanted to focus on, we got really focused on the high school through early college audience, that these were the people we wanted to influence, these were the people we wanted to bring into the STEM workforce, and in particular into computer security. And that had a lot of influence over the design and illustrations that we chose. It influenced the mechanics. I'll talk more about the mechanics in a few minutes. It influenced the level of technical detail that we wanted to talk about and how we talked about it. There were a lot of places where we realized terms like social engineering, dumpster diving, needed definitions for this audience. It influenced what jokes we included, in particular the maturity level of those jokes. And then the instructor guide, there's a couple of cards where we said, yeah, we want a little bit more maturity because we liked the way in which the content integrated, but we recognize they might not be high school appropriate sort of things. So as you develop a game, you don't have to start from scratch. And none of us, this is my second game, but none of us are masters at gaming mechanics. And so we realized that, we understood that. It turned out we have a connection to Steve Jackson Games, and we're able to reach out to them. Steve Jackson, for those of you who don't know, has been doing tabletop games, I think, for at least 30 years now, going back to Car Wars and Illuminati, which I played growing up. It was a tremendous thrill to get a chance to actually work with the guy. And it allowed us, more importantly, it allowed us to put our time and effort on the part that we were uniquely contributing. And so here we go, back to your egg example. This was here before, just so you know. The ingredients and expertise, we tapped into a lot of expertise on the game design side in order to make a game that we can make available. And these are discussed in the paper. I'm going to skim over them just a little bit. And one of the things that I've come to hold a strong belief on is how we get the game out there. You can see here we've got high quality production and shrink wrapping, elevation of privilege, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. Also invested money in graphic design and production. But there's a large range of choices here. There's download and self-print, which you can do with Elevation of Privilege because we were able to Creative Commons license it. You can print on demand. You can print in the US. You can print internationally. And when you make these sorts of choices, you've got trade-offs of things like cost per unit, customizability. With Elevation of Privilege, because it's Creative Commons, we make the source files available. People can modify it as they will, which is awesome. And that's in contrast to Control-Alt-Hack, which unfortunately, because we license the game mechanics from a commercial game producer, we can't give it away in the same way. We can't offer the same customizability as a matter of the legal agreements in place. There's a big quality difference. Zach and I were discussing this morning our experiences with GameCrafter doing print on demand and how the early days of GameCrafter, it wasn't the highest quality. It's getting much better. But there's a lot of distribution and production decisions which, when we went into the business of creating a game, was a learning experience for all of us. And so I think it's useful, I hope it's useful for you as game designers, people interested in games, to understand some of these trade-offs, because these distribution and production decisions seriously affect your timeline. They affect where you're going to do, how you're going to do your graphic design, how you're going to do your illustration, how you spend your budget. And I'll mention the difference between graphic design and illustration is graphic design is all of these visual elements, the logo, the font, the color scheme, and the illustration is things like the characters and the specifics. And I didn't know we needed both when I got started. Always a learning experience. One of the issues that I've been thinking about, the gears, the mechanics of all of this, and especially as I've gotten to now develop and ship two games, is when do you get to the point of having enough games, or when do games become overwhelming as a classroom thing? And one thing that I give a lot of thought to is the Red Queen effect, that you have to run faster and faster just to stay in the same place. And as we deliver more games into the student experience, I think we're going to encounter a very interesting thing, that the sorts of games that we can develop and deliver today to good effect, I'm hopeful, I'm optimistic that in 5 years we're going to look back on those games and cringe because they're no longer good enough, that the student experience of here's a game, will drive the quality level expected up in a way that makes it challenging for new designers to start designing and delivering games in the classroom. Another risk that comes up when I think about games in the classroom is, let's say you have 5 or 6 games through a 13-week course. All of a sudden, instead of learning the material that we hope pedagogically that students will come away with, they're spending their time learning a different game mechanic every other week and thinking about those game mechanics. And I suspect we've all seen people optimize, they game the games. And if we have too many games in the classroom, we come to the interesting question of, are people playing more with the games, or are they playing more with the learning goals that we hope to have? Related to that is, what happens if people are feeling saturated, if students are feeling saturated by games? Are we going to reach the point where they're like, oh God, another game? Can we actually just learn something today? I'm optimistic about students. You can tell I'm not at a university. There's also the question of what are we doing? And we've talked about rigorous evaluation a little bit. And as we worked on the game of Control-Alt-Hack, we spent a lot of time building the mechanics. And then we said, how do we measure this? Some of the goals that we had were things like increased awareness that these are career opportunities. How do you measure whether or not you're actually achieving that? How do you isolate between conflating variables? So is it the game that's getting people, or is it a different level of enthusiasm from an instructor? Is it the Hawthorne effect, where the Hawthorne effect comes from a factory study 80 or 90 years ago. They changed the incandescent bulbs to fluorescent bulbs and productivity went up. And then a few years later, they changed the fluorescent bulbs to incandescent bulbs and productivity went up again. And the Hawthorne effect is sometimes making a random change has an impact even though there's no causative effect. It's just, oh, something's different. And so how do you isolate that? How do we do evaluations for different stages, different styles of research? And perhaps one of the things I'm really hoping to learn over the next few years is, as we make these investments, we've poured some money into making each of these games. How do we quantify research investment versus research yield? And how do we deal with the fact that this was a longer, more complex project than drive most papers, right? If you're a grad student, you want to do research on games, I would encourage, or if you're a professor, one of your students wants to do research on games, I would encourage you to take a look at how much time and energy went into this production and say, that much work, one paper, well, one conference paper at CCS plus this paper, is that a worthwhile outcome for the research investment? And so With that, I will be happy to take questions.
Alan Sherman from UMBC. What evaluation have you done on your games?
So the evaluation is covered in more detail in the CCS paper, which was delivered over a year ago, so I might be a little bit off on this, on the details, but it was a survey instrument which we delivered to instructors at the NSF workshop on security education. We handed out copies of the game to the attendees, and with that we delivered a letter and asked them to respond to the survey, which had questions about level of interest, what happened when they did classroom evaluation, classroom use, and related sorts of things. So it was an open-ended survey.
So how did you manage evaluate the educational impact of this?
It's very difficult to evaluate the educational impact. We have anecdotes, but anecdotes obviously are not data. And I think it was a learning experience for all of us as we started out. We said, we'd like to do this, we'd like to explore the area. And when we got to the point of evaluation, A survey is a useful thing, but it's not nearly as precise as we'd like to be. And so I think that's an open area of research, is how do we actually evaluate the games that people are creating, and what is the trade-off between creating things that might be engaging and valuable. And the analogy that I'm using in my head is, in mathematics, we have things which we know are true or false, but we also know we can't prove. And there's a leap, obviously, between that and what we're doing here. But what's the right trade-off, or what are the optimal trade-offs? I don't have an answer for your question.
Okay, so on a related note, I mean, I would think that the danger of taking existing mechanic and modifying it, as you suggest, is that game players tend to abstract away everything but the core mechanics of the game. Mm-hmm. And so I expect that people who are used to playing games would then just abstract away everything that you've modified about the game, and therefore that wouldn't affect them. Do you think that's actually what happens in real life?
So observationally, no. We brought copies of the game to a large local company, and at the end of their security conference, they used it as a sort of wind down activity. Mm-hmm. And I had the opportunity to walk around and listen and be asked questions. And there were actually a fair number of, could someone really do that sort of questions that came out of the people playing the game. So at least the first time they play it, the first or second time they play it, we don't see people abstracting away those mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Or abstracting away the details.
Right.
Yes.
So, cool.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, Linda Oliva from UMBC. Since the game has been out for a while and you've seen a lot of people play it, and can you talk a little bit about what changes you might make to the game and how that mechanism of revising and adding to your game is going to proceed?
What changes would we make? Almost all of the criticism that's come up has been places that we knew we were making a trade-off. So, for example, there's a concern about the complexity of the game, that the mechanics take a good 5 or 7 minutes to explain to people, and then walking them through the first round of play can be a little challenging. We knew that going in, but we felt that the learning goal, the complexity, gave us an opportunity to reach some additional learning goals. So I think observationally, I'm pretty happy. I think the one thing that I might go back and revisit is we talked about doing something like putting QR codes on certain cards so that we could get both an opportunity to give additional information and, more important to your question, some analytics on what people are actually using the game and seeing that. And it turned out that putting QR codes onto the cards had substantial production cost impacts, both in terms of the physical size of the cards and how much information we need, but also in terms of putting up and then maintaining a website. And I think that's a decision that I wonder if we made the right choice there.
Alan Sherman again. Would you please talk a little bit more about why you chose to go with a card game and the consequence of that decision?
A card game versus an electronic game, or just a card?
A card game versus a digital game.
Okay. So this actually was, and I'll presage my next talk on elevation of privilege. What I saw in doing that work was that the physical cards in people's hands caused them to shove aside their laptops and get focused on exactly what they were doing, and there was a lot of social interaction between the players. Also, the physical nature of the cards communicates the message and sets the scene that this is a game. We're doing something game-like, we're doing something fun. Whereas if you're sitting there at your laptop and you have a game in one window, an instant messenger in another, and then your email in a third window, it's harder for the game to be as immersive. And obviously there are high quality games electronically that are very, very immersive. They're more expensive to produce is the other thing. The last element of a card game versus an electronic game is the physical object provides an opportunity for introducing or communicating or showing, you know, doing, having this in my office and I can show it to people and physically draw their attention to it is a different interaction than let's point at a screen together. And I lack the theoretical grounding to really explain why this is so important, but the responses that I've personally seen make me very fond of card games, very fond of physical objects in game delivery, despite all of the downsides of production cost and availability and whatnot.